So we've been on a bit of a journey together, and we're on the last lap, I guess, of this particular session, and we come to bhava, life, becoming life. Existence, being. Please tell us.
Gee, right, poetical. Okay, good. Let us have a look at bhava. One of the translations Bandhusajata was just mentioning was the idea of becoming, whether becoming really is a suitable translation for this term bhava. That's an interesting discussion in its own right. But there is a big difference between the idea of becoming and the idea of existence. Yeah, there's one thing is the state that you are in, and it's maybe a desire for a particular state in the future as well. But becoming is a process. So in the suttas, you have, for example, you have desire for bhava. And that would imply that you have craving to become, which is kind of weird because becoming itself is a craving, really. Yeah, so it means like you're craving to crave, which is not entirely wrong. I mean, it can be, but that is not what is really meant in this particular context. So becoming is a bit funny because it implies craving to crave, really, craving to become. But it's a particular, when we think about the future, we don't think about a perpetual process of becoming. That's not what we crave for. What we crave for is a particular state, a particular rebirth, a particular sense of identity, a particular status in society or whatever it is. That's what we crave for. So I think it's quite appropriate to translate bhava as a existence or being, as you say, or life even, rather than becoming.
Some erroneous translators shall remain nameless.
Okay. So now I think that's right. I mean, actually, there is a separate word in Pali for becoming, and that is bhava. There's bhava and bhava. And bhava is a, causative. That's exactly the word I'm looking for, the causative form of bhava. And so causing, the becomes above it, it means to develop, and which is the causative form. That is when you are becoming something. Yeah. Anyway, so what is this all about? So here we have the translations by Bandhusajata, continued existence for bhava. And then you have the idea of rebirth. So you want to look at how all of these things actually, how they work together, how they actually function together to give rise to this thing that we call existence. And to do that, I'm just going to skip a number of slides that we used before, but we won't even look at now, and we go straight to those suttas that actually deal with the question of bhava directly. So here we have the various ways of taking up, and then we have the, I'll talk about this later on as we get there, but here we come to the sutta which deals with this idea of existence of bhava. So let's see what it has to say. This is the Venerable Ananda asking the Buddha, in what way, Bhante, is there existence? What is the meaning of this term, bhava? So bhava, probably, what he says, I can't remember. Bhava, bhava, Bhante. And this is the Buddha's reply. If Ananda, there were no kamma ripening in the sensory realm, would there be sense-sphere existence? So, in other words, existence in a particular realm depends on the kamma that ripens in that realm. And what this means, it shows you a little bit about the idea of bhava, how it kind of straddles two different lives. Some of these terms are not necessarily kind of precisely defined as belonging to one life or another one. We saw this with consciousness before, and consciousness and bhava are very, very closely related to each other. Consciousness at the very beginning, you had the sankhara, paccaya, vijnana, from the choices the condition of choice is you have consciousness, and consciousness is conditioned in this very life by the choices we make, and then according to that conditioning then carries on into the future. And bhava is exactly the same principle, and you see it right there. You have the kamma, which you build up in this life. It builds up a particular kind of existence in your mind, and as a consequence of building up that particular existence in your mind, then the rebirth happens in accordance to that. And so what do we mean by this kind of existence? And how do we, can we experience this existence? And the answer is yes, to some extent you can. And this, I already mentioned this during the, when I discussed consciousness before, but maybe just very briefly recap this idea. And the idea is that your existence, you know, right now, it may not match precisely the fact that you are in the human realm, because one thing is our kind of physical external existence in terms of our senses and things, but our inner existence may have developed in a different direction. So psychologically, we may not be in the same realm as we are physically, if you know what I mean. Yeah, this is precisely the whole purpose of developing the spiritual path, is that psychologically you kind of evolve out of the lower existence into something higher. So your consciousness may actually be in a slightly different place. So where is our consciousness at? How can we know that? And the way you can know that is simply through introspection. That's how you find these things out. Yeah. And in particular, if you have a bit of time to calm down and to get rid of the kind of usual disturbances in life, or the disturbances of restlessness and excessive craving and ill will that you may have. Maybe you go on a meditation retreat, you kind of sleep for a couple of days to get rid of all the tiredness that you know is so common in our world. One of the things you read about, one of the kind of big detriments of the connected society we live in, that everyone is tired all the time. Yeah, people have less energy to live life properly. People are becoming more stupid. Apparently, it's true. Yeah, IQ is going down because you're so tired all the time, you can't think properly anymore. So the IQ is kind of dropping in society. It's kind of scary what this world can do to us sometimes. So once you get over that, and then you look at what remains in your mind, when the mind kind of reaches its baseline, because it's kind of the baseline you get down to, and then you meditate, you try to watch the breath, or you try to breathe in the present moment, and you see what your mind does. And where that mind inclines, where that mind tends to hang out, what that mind is interested in, that is your existence in this life. And what you will find is that your mind, well, what is it interested in? You will find that very often it is interested in the things of the sensory realm. Yeah, we had the kam upadana, so the grasping to, it says sense pleasures there, but I would say grasping in the sensory realm. It's much broader than just the sense pleasure. Sounds like a very narrow thing. It's grasping in the entire sensory realm. Yeah. If you find that your mind inclines towards thinking about your family, your job, problems in that sensory realm, entertainments that you would like to see, food you would like to eat, yeah, everything in that sensory realm. And there is so much, almost our entire lives revolve around the sensory realm. Yeah, this is such an important thing to understand. When we talk about sensual pleasures, we don't just mean the desires in that realm. What we mean is our entire attachment, our entire lives that are lived almost fully in that realm. From the moment you wake up in the morning to the moment you go to bed at night, the sensory realm is really what our minds are, that what we are immersed in, yeah, completely immersed in this realm. So of course, we are going to be very, tend to be attached to that realm because it is our entire lives. Then you go on retreat and you see that's actually exactly what happens. Your mind inclines towards those things. It thinks about those things. And unless you use willpower, you will tend to stay with those things. So the idea here is to go on retreat, use no willpower, and see what your mind leans to. And that's why you kind of roughly know what your bhava, your existence, is in this life. But you will find that it is not always in the sensory realm. Yeah, sometimes as you meditate, as you your mind, you start to see the disadvantages in the world of the sensory world, and your mind starts to incline towards more towards meditation practice, your mind may incline towards peace. Yeah, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself now because this is really the next bhava here. So let's just stick with this one for now. I'll come back to the other one in a second. Yeah. So would there be sense existence if there was no ripening in the sensory realm? No, yeah, because your mind is not inclining towards those things. Thus, Ananda, for beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Yeah. So here the Buddha is just kind of starting out this idea of how bhava happens. And he starts out by saying, for beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. Yeah. And this is a standard phrase. We saw it before, actually, very briefly, I think. Yeah. And this is something you find many, many places in the suttas in various contexts. And it is a very beautiful summary of the problem that we are faced with in this life. We are hindered by ignorance because ignorance is what blinds us. It means that we are in the dark. We don't see things as they actually are. Either we don't see at all because it's in the dark, or we see distortions. We see mirages where actually there is no mirage. Yeah, and we are completely blinded by what is going on. And when you are hindered by ignorance, you can't see what happens. Well, you hit your head in the beams in the ceiling. You stub your toes on the floor. You fall over when you kind of walk over the a root in the ground or whatever. Ignorance, not being able to see darkness around us, is always going to be problematic. It must lead to suffering. It's kind of obvious when you think about it. Hindered by ignorance. Yeah, there's no light. The purpose of the path is to get the light to turn on so we can actually see what is going on. So we don't have to hit our head against the rafters anymore, etc., etc. So ignorance is the root problem. And then because of that ignorance, we crave, and that craving is what fetters us, what ties us to the round of existence. The craving is what perpetuates the rebirth. Yeah, it's like the rope that ties you to the round of existence and then drives you on. These two powerful forces coming together, the blindness on the one hand and the fetter and the rope that ties you down on the other. So anyway, that gives you a beautiful kind of summary of the problem that we are faced with from a kind of, more philosophical perspective. Yeah, so for beings in this thing, kamma is the field. Why is kamma the field? Well, you have made kamma that leads to the sensory realm. So that is the field. It's like where your mind is heading. Yeah, that's where you're going to be. Where you're going to be sown, so to speak. Yeah, consciousness is that seed which gets sown in that field. Yeah, the field here is really just another way of saying a particular plane of existence. Yeah, that's really what it means here. That plane inside of you now, and then that plane then becomes real when you get reborn. Consciousness is the seed that is planted in that particular realm. Once the consciousness seed is planted, craving then becomes the moisture that makes it grow. Yeah, it grows in that realm. And what growing here means, it just means that consciousness takes different shapes according to how you live your life. If you live your life well, consciousness grows in a positive way. You live your life in a bad way, then consciousness heads in a bad direction towards more suffering. So the growing here really is just the growing of rebirth, the growing of future existence. That is really what is meant here. So this seed becomes a plant which kind of builds up, and then it kind of has its next seed coming from the plant when it's fully grown. The next seed comes out. The next seed falls into the new karma field of the next future life. And then more craving starts, makes it grow in that future existence again in the future. So the growing of consciousness just means that the potential for rebirth in the future, craving drives it on. For the consciousness to be established in an inferior realm. Yeah, the Hinaya Dhatu, is that the Dhatu that's used here?
Hinaya Dhatu.
So Hinaya means like Hinayana, it's the same word as they have in Hinayana. Yeah, the kind of the inferior realm. And that is where... That's kind of the human realm. It's called the inferior realm in these kind of things. So here we are in the inferior realm. In this way, there is a rebirth in the future. Of course, that is just the beginning of this particular sutta. It goes on to three more, and it talks about the middling realm and the... the superior realm, and the middling realm is then the realm of the jhanas, the samadhi realms. Yeah. So when you go on your meditation retreat and you find that your mind is inclining towards peace, is inclining towards samadhi, inclining towards all of those things, it means that you are established in that samadhi realm, or established in that realm. You can see there are many sub-realms here. Yeah, the sutta gives you three main kind of areas. Yeah, the three areas of the sensory realm, the jhana realm, and then the arupa, the formless realm. But there are subsidiary realms within this. Yeah, obviously. So this is just like a broad overview. So then you see whether your mind, how deep does your meditation go? That will show you again how. Give you some idea of where you exist right now, and then when, where that will lead you in the future, yeah, etc., etc., all the way up to the very highest. So that is the idea of existence. Then that existence that you have then in this life, well, because you're already existing in a certain way, it is a tendency of the consciousness, the inclination of the consciousness, because consciousness has an inclination, then when you die, it carries on with that same inclination into the future, and then rebirth happens accordingly in that way. So what happens if there is no bhava? Yeah, this is the interesting thing. What about, Bhanasudhara is saying that we haven't kind of looked at the cessation sequence. Maybe we should look at the cessation sequence here a little bit as well. So if there is no craving, yeah, you don't react to the feelings anymore because you realize that craving is counterproductive. Craving is in itself suffering, and you cannot procure any happiness with craving anyway, so you might as well let it be. Then you don't take anything up in the world. You don't lean towards any of these things. You're not interested in any of these. You don't hold on to views anymore. You don't hold on to the sensory realm. You still live in that realm. But you know that these things are impermanent. They can go at any time. There's no grasping onto any of these things. And what that means in your mind is that when you sit down in meditation, your mind is not interested in anything. It doesn't hold on to anything. Yeah, it just lets get everything go. And you just go deeper and deeper and deeper automatically. Yeah? And this is why if you are, the kind of more wise you are about these things, the more insight you have into this teaching, the less craving you have, the less upadana you have, the easier it is for you to become peaceful, because you just let go like that. It's automatic for you. You know that there's nothing there to be held on to. The mind isn't leaning towards anything at all. Yeah. Eventually, the consciousness just drops everything, and everything is completely gone as a consequence. There's no holding on to any of these things. So there's no leaning towards any of these things. And because there is no inclination towards any of these realms, anything within the five khandhas, it means that when you die, because the consciousness isn't inclining towards anything, it just stops instead, and there's no kind of movement into the future. That craving which drives you on into the future, that projects the five khandhas into a new existence, is no longer there. It may seem a bit mysterious, yeah, and to some extent it is, because these, you know, to be able to see this really requires a deep insight into the nature of craving and all these kind of things. But I think the general idea sort of makes sense, though. Yeah. Okay, well, that is the idea of bhava. Would you like to add anything to these
these things? Thank you. That's very kind of you to invite me to have something to say. It's nice to have something to say, isn't it?
Sometimes, yeah.
would you be so kind, Venerable Sir,
absolutely,
as to pull up AN 3.76 for me.
Oh, that was like, yeah, okay, so this is the real deal.
The real deal, yes, with the... I just want to make just a couple of points. So we've been talking about the Pali word bhava, and we mentioned that... I just want to add a few things, just... oops, there you go. A few things to... round out that discussion. So first of all, the word bhava is a noun from the verb to be. That's where the root of it comes from. And as such, the root to be obviously is one of the, if not the most common verbs in the language, and bhava, a very kind of common, ordinary word. It's used sort of colloquially in the language in a similar way to which sometimes we might use the word life. And you get that usage in the Ratna Sutta, for example, Na te bhavang attamang adiyanti. They don't take up an eighth. So talking about a stream enterer can only be reborn seven times, so they do not take up an eighth bhava. So there you can see the eighth life, or eighth existence perhaps, but you couldn't say an eighth becoming in that case, it wouldn't make any sense, or even an eighth being doesn't really make any sense. So this is why these kind of, bhava has a more sort of concrete sense than we might think from a kind of more abstract, like if you approach it from a more abstract sense, if you think of it in terms of being, right? Being's not incorrect as a translation, but it tends to make it, it's a bit more woo-woo about what exactly you mean. And bhava means a life, as in my past life, I was Cleopatra, for example. And this kind of meaning. And so the idea of bhava is a bit, it's a tricky one as a translator to try to capture it, because, you know, on the one hand, etymologically, it's very simple, but the sense of it and the connotations are difficult to convey, because when you're talking about bhava, you're talking about this ongoing process of existence. So I sometimes translate it as continued existence. Sometimes I just translate it as rebirth, or translate it in trying to different ways according to context, or usually continued existence or ongoing existence or something like that, to try to give this kind of sense for bhava. It's like a... And a bhava, like a countable bhava, is a bit similar to the concept of vijñānatthiti that we were talking about the other day, like a station of consciousness. So it's like you have a certain kamma, which is going to almost project your mind into a certain bhava, and within that bhava there's a certain stability for that period of time. So that one life, your bhava is sort of around that kind of region, and then maybe in the next life it's going to go to another dimension or another realm. So that imagery around the seed and the growing and the moisture and all of those kinds of things. I mean, even the kama dhatu vepakancha, the vepakancha is to ripenable, literally is the ripenable kama. Yeah, and so it's a very kind of organic set of imagery which is being evoked here. And this is historically one of the sources for which the idea of rebirth came about. Because people can see in nature that trees will grow and they will leave their seeds and they will come up. And people look and they see nature is in cycles. And everywhere you look, there are cycles happening in nature. Life and death going round and round and round. And the simile of the seed giving rise to rebirth was taken not just in India, but you find the same thing in ancient Greece. For example, one of the legends of Pythagoras was that Pythagoras died because he was being chased by his enemies, and he came to a field of beans, and he refused to go across the beans because he refused to kill any of the bean plants by running across them. Why? Because inside the beans, each bean has a life, a soul. And you know that because if you eat them, you tootle them out the back. You fart. And those farts are the souls which are trapped inside the beans. Anyway, that's the story. If it's true or not, I cannot say. I wasn't there, and I don't know Pythagoras personally, so I don't know if that's true. But so this idea that I find this a very kind of evocative idea, like that consciousness is the seed, right? So there's like, you know, you think of the seed as like DNA, and it's like encoding of the information that's needed for a new life. Yeah, that's what DNA does. That's what's in the seed. Huh? And what one of the things also that's interesting is here, because here, of course, we are. You know, we're near the end of the 12 factors of dependent origination. And how do we explain this? What when we're talking about it, how do we explain it? Well, vijñānang, which is, of course, right at the beginning. Yeah? Kammang, which is equivalent to sankharas, also right at the beginning. And tanha is similar, as we've seen in this sutra itself, where you have this phrase that we've pointed out a few times, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. showing that ignorance and craving, of course, going together in this particular case. So that Buddha's explaining bhava effectively with the first three factors of dependent origination. So once again, this is one of the reasons why we talk about in terms of a spiral, there are these repeating patterns and so on that's going on. So bhava is encapsulating all that whole kind of process, and it has, according to the tradition, and I think justified by context like this, that bhava has both passive and active sides. So it has in terms of like we get reborn into a bhava, but when you're in that bhava, that existence, part of the characteristic of being in that existence is that you act. I mean, of course, depending on what kind of existence. Some kinds of existence might be more passive and you're not really doing very much, but certainly in the human realm, you get to do things. That's part of what it means to be human, and you are making those actions and you're making those karmas. And so that is then driving the dependent origination again and fueling the cycle for another turn. So that's just a few points I wanted to make on that.
Yeah, it's interesting how this is an expansion on sankhara in a sense. You know, sankhara is here kind of expanded out into three terms: tanha, upadana, bhava, craving, right. Grasping, and bhava, which really is that expansion of the choices, yeah. And you kind of make it into something. So it's nice to have that two sides to it, because it gives you a kind of further understanding what it actually involves. It involves, and one of the things that you see right there, what it does involve is that the idea of choices does not just involve the act of craving and desiring, but it involves things like, you know, grasping, which is attachments, basically. Attachment is part of that. And that is a very useful thing to understand for meditation practice, because one of the reasons why we are blocked in meditation is precisely things that we hold on to. Yeah, the grasping. You hold on to the sensory realm. You cannot let go of the idea of seeing or hearing or the body or whatever. That actually blocks you. You come to a plateau. It doesn't go deeper. Why not? Well, there's something you're holding on to, something which is stopping you. You may not have a very active craving, anything going on in your mind, and yet there is an underlying tendency to hold on to that world. So it brings out a kind of a new dimension, in a sense, to the kind of this idea of craving and desire and choices, etc., which makes it very interesting. Yeah. One of the things about the Satipatthana Sutta is that it doesn't give very clear, precise instructions on what exactly to do. It just tells you that you are aware of the feelings and you are aware of the mind, the chitta-anupassana. It doesn't tell you the context in which that happens. The first Satipatthana, kaya-anupassana, the contemplation of the body, it is there. You have more instructions. You have the 31 parts of the body. You have some idea what to contemplate. The breath is mentioned there. But the rest of it is kind of a bit more ambiguous. I think that is why there are so many different interpretations. Yeah, some people say you just watch the feelings in the body everywhere. But I would argue that the context for that meditation is the breath meditation. At least that is the usual context. Yeah. So what you really are doing is that you're just watching the breath. And then as the breath unfolds, then these steps happen more or less by themselves. I think we may have a look at the Anapanasati Sutta tomorrow. So these feelings arise through the breath contemplation. Yeah, the contemplation of mind also happens through the breath contemplation. And that, I think, has always been the easiest way to understand this, because then there is a clear kind of anchor. There's something that you can be aware of, and then the stages happen through that. And if you go to the Anapanasati Sutta, then it is basically a samatha practice, a calming practice, all the way up to the 12th step, which is the same as the citta, the ending of the citta nupassana. Then you have the dhamma nupassana, which Bandhasudrata translated as contemplation of principles. Yeah, we can maybe translate as mental qualities or something like that as well, or some mental qualities. But the idea there, the very last step, is first of all, it is the contemplation of the hindrances. So that is where you understand causality specifically, and you understand what it is that blocks you at the very end of this thing. And then it is the contemplation of the bhujangas, which is the arising of the factors that lead to jhanas, etc. And then finally, it is the contemplation that leads to the full insight into the three characteristics in relation to the five khandhas. And this is what you find in Dhamma Nupassana. All of that is included within the last one, the Dhamma Nupassana part. So I think that, you know, most of it is just a kind of breath meditation. And of course, one of the things that we should not underestimate as well is that for breath meditation to work, you have to reflect on the meditation process itself. Why is it working? Why is it not working? So when we talk about breath meditation, we don't mean just watching the breath. We mean at the end of it, asking ourselves, you know, what is stopping us from going deeper? Why did I have success today? What are the perceptions that work in my meditation? And this is can be regarded as a kind of Dhamma Nupassana or something like that, that you do, you know, at the end of every meditation, especially when it goes reasonably well, then you have some data to work with, and then you can kind of do that. So then you are reborn according to this process of Bhava, yeah, and this is a very interesting translation by Bhantasujato, the idea of translating jati as rebirth rather than birth. And I think I mentioned this before, but I want to mention it again, because one of the problems with Pali, any language, is that terms have a meaning which the audience, yeah, depending on what the audience is, they will hear different things. And the audience in ancient India, when they heard a word like jati, it would be implied automatically that that meant rebirth. Yeah, that would be kind of the meaning of that term. And so, but we, when we hear the word birth, it is not implied at all that it refers to rebirth. So if we want the modern audience to hear the same thing that the ancient Indian audience heard, you have to render it as rebirth. Yeah, otherwise it doesn't work. And this is a very interesting principle of translation. You have to put yourself almost in their shoes to understand what they were talking about to make them understand that.
And just to sort of on that is that I mean, actually, the word, the English word birth, doesn't mean actually jati at all. Actually, the English word birth means when the baby emerges from the womb.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Which in Pali is vijati.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You have to specifically distinguish it and say vijati is when the baby
which
is born.
Separate.
Yeah.
But that's a very important point, because what that means is that this is basically the establishing of consciousness in a new life. It's a different time point in time, and that kind of. It's important to know these little things, because then if you know little details like that, the whole process of the 12 links kind of comes out more clearly. And another example of that, of kind of translating things, is a discussion that we had with Bhantasujata a long time ago. That was the word Nibbana. Yeah, what should we do? Should we just keep it as Nibbana? We will notice that when you read Buddhist books, the majority of people just keep the term Nibbana there. But is that a good idea? There is certain downsides. Yeah, if you keep the word Nibbana without specifying it, you allow people to read whatever they want into that term, because they have no idea what it actually means. But for the ancient Indian audience, Nibbana also had a very specific meaning. Yeah, it meant something like extinguishing, the going out of the flame. So for that reason, we agreed on this. We don't always agree, but sometimes we agree. It's good that we don't always agree, otherwise, that's really terrible. But we decided, okay, let's call this extinguishment. And this is something that I was discussing with Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi as well, who's one of the kind of prime translators of the suttas. Originally, we thought about the word extinction, but extinction has a very negative feeling. So extinguishment is what we ended with. So that's another example of that. Yeah, what does the audience hear? You want to give people that feeling of the same that they had at that time.
I find myself kind of leaning towards it's quenching sometimes. I mean, quenching isn't bad, especially in verses. Extinguishment is sometimes really clumsy in verses.
Yeah.
What do you think about quenching? Because quenching it's the extinguishment of thirst as well, which isn't bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So for that, yeah. Okay.
Very good.
Yeah.
Of course, for most people, young people, Nirvana is a band.
Is that right view or wrong view? I'm not sure.
I don't know.
Not sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Does that mean so? Extinguish again gets us back to extinguishing all tanha.
extinguishing many things. There's many things that get extinguished. Tanha is one of them. You could also argue all defilements, including delusion, gets extinguished. All delusion, yeah. Suffering gets extinguished. That's another thing that gets extinguished. There's a number of things. And sometimes I think the term extinguishment or nirvana is often scary for... It can sound scary, yeah? Who wants to be extinguished? But if you think of it as extinguishment of suffering, then it becomes like a very positive term, yeah? I mean, in the Dhammapada, you find the nirvana paramang sukhang, yeah? Nirvana is the highest happiness. That is something that we can relate to in some way, at least partially, yeah? And it has a positive psychological sense.
But also, it should be scary.
Sometimes, not all the time, though. Is that right?
It should be.
Yeah, okay.
There should be something which is challenging about it. It shouldn't be just kind of... realizing nirvana, it's not like going to a day spa or something like that. It's like, oh, I'm going to get pampered and everything's going to be nice and stuff. It should be challenging, right? Because giving up everything. And if you're not a bit freaked out by it, then it's not quite doing its job.
Yeah, true. But we also need to see that it is a good outcome. Yeah, you can't just be freaked out. If you think, because otherwise, no point in being a Buddhist. If it's just, you know, you have to kind of see that there's a good grounds for being freaked out, and that actually freaking out is actually good in this particular case. It's not a negative thing. Sometimes freaked out is just bad. Anyway.
Well, that's right. But that's what stops complacency, right? You know, like the devas who are freaked out by the nirvana.
For me, I would argue it's better to be freaked out by samsaric existence.
Oh, yeah?
You said that nirvana isn't a day spa.
Really? I apologize, and I withdraw that statement. Yes. I think there's a samsara like furniture shop or something like that around the place.
There's a perfume
called samsara. My favorite one was when we were invited for dana at a wealthy Upasika's house one time, and it's all very kind of posh place, and there's all these fancy cars and all of this kind of stuff. I was there with a Thai monk, and in the hallway there were some shopping bags, and one of the shopping bags was Max Mara. So I explained to the Thai monk, I said, I'll see that, and I explained to him what it means, you know, and he just laughed.
Yeah, please.
Yes, of course you can. And I mean, for example, with bhava, then I'm usually translating it as continued existence. And it's very true that you can't map one word onto another word. I mean, any translation is approximate. In that particular case, and cessation of suffering, you can't really use that, because then you'll inevitably have a verse somewhere that says nibbana is the cessation of suffering. So then your cessation of suffering is the cessation of suffering. This is the problem, is that sometimes... One of the things with Nibbana is that it has a very specific set of like imagery and connotations around burning and fire and the going out of the fire and so on. And if you lose that... You know, that's one of the things where if you just say Nibbana, you lose that set of connotations, in English anyway. So you want to try to do something that's going to talk about... That's going to... You sort of... In a way, you can try to build up a sort of set of imagery and connotations when people are reading the suttas by reflecting the metaphorical backgrounds of words as well. Putting out, you could use putting out or going out or something like that. And again, a lot of the times that these, when I was translating, I would often try to use more colloquial translations like that. In fact, I think I tried to use something like going out or something like that for Nibbana. But eventually, sometimes they're just not linguistically flexible enough, because in translations you can't always fully determine how it is you want to use a word. You know what I mean? So if you were doing it in English, you'd be able to phrase it in a way that was going to make sense. But if it's in the Pali, then sometimes you're constrained about how you're going to express it. But yeah, I think like to translate it as going out would actually be a good translation.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then some people think it means going to a nightclub. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things about this particular connection, yeah, between rebirth and old age, death, and suffering, is that sometimes you see the dependent relation, what is called patiloma. Yeah, you see the reverse sequence. In other words, it starts with old age and death, and it goes backwards to ignorance. Yeah, so you see the forward movement, which is called anuloma, and patiloma is the reverse sequence. And you find this in places like the Mahapadana Sutta, Digha Nikaya 14, the great lineage, or whatever it's called. Is that what you translate as? It's a lineage of past Buddhas, essentially. And what you find in these suttas is that the Buddha starts off with the problem, yeah, because suffering is the problem that we have. Old age and death is the problem that we have. And then the harvest of deeds. Wow, that's pretty cool. So,
Apadana is one of these difficult words, but it seems to be from the idea of a harvest, of reaping what you sow, like deeds and
It's the same as avadana, isn't it? The same word, a P and a V. Yeah, yeah. So the Buddha often starts off at the end, and then he asks the question, what is the cause? Yeah, and this is kind of a beautiful way of thinking about dependent origination. We have a problem. Why do we have this problem? And then he goes then from old age and suffering, death, all the way back to ignorance. And then he asks, and always this is what is called, this is actually called specifically Yoniso Manasikara in the suttas, wise attention, this is one of the core examples of using wise and proper attention in the suttas. And so what is the cause of old age and death? And as Buddhists, we don't even think about it. Yeah, of course, birth is the cause of this. But if you ask a person on the street, in Sydney or in Perth or wherever, what is the cause of your suffering? Nobody would ever say birth. Yeah, that's kind of completely out of the range of ordinary people. It just doesn't happen. And the reason why people wouldn't say that, because it's not really a solution. There's no solution in saying that there is birth, right? Why are you suffering? Because I had an argument with my partner, my husband or wife. Yeah, I'm suffering because my children are misbehaving. I'm suffering because I broke my leg. I got fired from my job. I'm feeling depressed today. There's endless number of reasons why I might be suffering. And if you can pin it down in that way, well, then we think we can find a solution. Yeah, that's what we think. We think we can find a solution that way to problem. And this is what makes the Buddha's teaching so radical and so different. Instead of giving that kind of ordinary solution that most of us are looking for in life, the Buddha's actually realized this is not really a solution. There is no solution in that area. Yes, we may kind of put a Band-Aid on the wound for a while. It may heal a little bit, and then another problem arises soon afterwards. So this is a very radical statement. Yeah, the idea that actually the problem is much, much deeper than that. The problem is the idea of birth in the first place. That is why we are suffering. That is why it is there. And when you think about that, what it actually means is that once you are reborn, that's it. You've had it. There is no solution in that realm. We're never going to be able to, yes, we can fix up climate change a little bit by having good policies. We can have less COVID by having a good political system that kind of organizes the vaccines and the things in the right way and locks down when we have to lock down, except for the Rydges Hotel. Don't lock down the Rydges Hotel. We're doing two things too important to be kind of stopped by COVID. And we can kind of help to make the world a better place by good policies. But the problem is always going to be there. The problem is not going to be resolved at its root by fixing up things in the world. The problem is birth in the first place. It's a very radical statement. It's something that nobody ever thinks of. Nobody would say that. So this is this actually is much deeper than it may appear at first sight. This is also one of the reasons why it is so important to translate it as rebirth in this particular context. Yeah, because once you understand it as rebirth rather than just birth, well, then it makes sense to end birth. Ending birth doesn't make all that much sense because I was born in this life and then I'm going to expire and what's the big deal? But once you understand it as rebirth, well, then this whole idea of ending birth or rebirth actually starts to make sense. So it really only makes sense in the context of of the samsaric existence, of going round and round and moving on to a new life in the future. So this is kind of the idea of. It seems so obvious, yeah, but actually, it's to me when you think about it, actually, it's a very profound idea. This idea that rebirth is really the problem, and not just ordinary problems of the world. So that is the first point I want to make. I want to make more points. I just want to kind of pause for a second. But do you want to say anything about that?
No, I think that's already good.
Yeah. Good. Point, yeah. Yep. Okay. Any questions?
Are we going to just look at the definitions of the term?
Sure, absolutely. You want to look at that now?
Sure, sometime.
What is rebirth? So this is the standard definition of rebirth, found, or of birth, of jati, found in the suttas. Yeah, we discussed this briefly before, but just to make it absolutely clear that rebirth does not mean mind moments. It does not mean thoughts arising in the present moment or the next moment. It means rebirth, inception, conception, reincarnation, manifestation of the aggregates, acquisition of the sense fields or the senses of the various sentient beings in the various orders of sentient beings. And
there's a lot of synonyms here you have to try to capture in English, but yeah.
But yeah, but the Pali is quite, what does it have? Jati, sanjati.
Jati, sanjati, or kanti, abhinibhati.
Yeah, but the point is that all of these words in the Pali language refer to rebirth, yeah, the arising of the aggregates in a new life. And as I mentioned before, when the Buddha talks about the arising of a thought and the passing away of thought or feelings or perceptions or whatever, he uses a very different kind of language, different kind of words. He doesn't use these words here. These words are specifically set aside to talk about the rebirth process. So they couldn't get much clearer than this. Here's another we saw this before, but another definition of rebirth.
So the first one is from the Samyutta, this one's from the Digha.
Yeah. The rebirth of sentient beings into the various realms, gods, fairies, I like that one, fairies, spirits, creatures, humans, quadrupeds, birds, that used to be called bipeds in the old days. We called it birds, which kind of is nice. And reptiles. What is reptiles? Is it sitting sipa or something?
Like that,
yeah, yeah, sitting sipa. Each into their own realm. Quadrupeds is just like dogs and four-legged animals. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't have the cortex. So this is also lying in a biological...
It is actually. It is, in a sense, yeah. Going down from the gods and going down, yeah. That is true.
We should have gone on to amoeba.
I mean, it's that's true. I mean, it's not necessarily meant to be sort of comprehensive. Obviously, like fish and so on could be included, but the word I've translated as reptiles is sarisapa, which is perhaps reptile is a little bit too. I think it probably includes like insects and things like that. I'm not sure where fish should be in there somewhere as well. But anyway, so yeah, it's meant to be more inclusive than that. But yeah, as it stands, it does sort of more or less go down that sort of evolutionary thing, doesn't it? Yeah. Centipedes wouldn't be included in Sarisapa. Yeah, Satapadi. Yeah.
Satapadi, exactly. And Musika, missing. Where do you have this? Do you have it there? What is the Pali for this? Satupada, okay. Tesang tesang satanang tatatajadin. Okay. Usually it has kind of an inclusive phrase at the end, saying whatever beings into whatever realms. Whatever beings,
So okay. That's right. So it finishes off with a very inclusive fragment as phrase as well. Te san te sancha hi ananda satanang tadataya jati nabhavisa, where te san te sang means is an emphatic distributive phrase, whatever kind.
Yeah.
anywhere that they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Okay. Yeah.
I like this one.
Old age?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Growing old.
But before we get to this.
My teeth are very broken. My hair.
Your teeth are all right.
My teeth are not all right. You ask my dentist. No, they're very bad. Grayness of hair. No, this is all plastic.
Is it?
Yeah, it's all plastic.
Ah,
yeah, none of this
is
real.
That's why it looks so good, then.
No, this is real. Yeah. Wrinkling of skin, decline of vitality, degeneration. Where's my glasses? Degeneration.
Where's my glasses? Well, I can't have them now, so we understand. Yeah. So this is good. Yeah, the old age of various beings and the various order of beings. They're growing old. The brokenness, the grayness, the wrinkling of the skin, the decline of vitality, degeneration of the faculties. You didn't say anything about that.
Oh, my glasses.
That's a good point. Yeah, yeah. This is called old age. Yeah. So you're getting
very specific, isn't it?
Are you getting older? I guess this is a sign.
Watch.
Yep.
Can we also argue
you never feel
that this is reality, but this is also a very suffering view, a pessimistic view of old age. Because with old age, there is all sorts of things we gain.
Pensions?
More than
parking
pensions.
Spots?
more valuable than pensions, this word called wisdom.
Really?
Sometimes you get wise, sometimes you don't. It depends on the person. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Of course,
yeah.
But this is not about what is gained as we.
That's right, yeah.
Mm.
And actually, in helping geriatric patients, helping ourselves, people, we also actually need to look at what we've gained.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Not just the sufferings that we have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the point here, you know, the whole point of this one here is to look at the downside of things. And that's the whole point. Yeah.
This is
the thing about, you know, this is one of the things about the Buddha's teaching. They always talk about three things in the suttas. They talk about the asada, the adinava, and the nisarana. You know those, Enkong?
No.
So the asada is the whatever is beneficial, whatever is good about something. Yeah. And he always said the same thing with the sensory realm. I've been saying things, bad things about the sensory realm, but of course there is an attraction in the sensory realm. We enjoy the things of the senses. So there is an attraction there. So there's always the positive side in something. Well, can be, not always, but very often.
But that's not highlighted in all the teachings that we are receiving from all the members.
No, but that's what I'm telling you now. Yeah, this is the opportunity. That now is a chance. Yeah. then you have the adinava. Adinava means that the drawback or the disadvantage or the downside of things. And then you balance out the upside with the downside. And then you say, nisarana, I'm getting out of here. This is how it works. So the Buddha does not deny the fact that there is attractions in things in the world. But he balances out and thinks, okay, the right way of this is actually getting out of this. It's called the nisarana, yeah. So, yeah.
If I may. So I've mentioned this a couple of times, but I think it's worth, I'm just going to read it now. So this is from The Guardian a few days ago, was it last week? Aging process is unstoppable, finds unprecedented study. Research suggests humans cannot slow the rate at which they get older because of biological constraints. Thank you, science. Immortality and everlasting youth are the stuff of myths, according to new research, which may finally end the eternal debate about whether we can live forever. So just in case you're wondering, backed by governments, business, academics, investors in an industry worth $110 billion and estimated to be worth $610 billion, by 2025, crikey, scientists have spent decades attempting to harness the power of genomics and artificial intelligence to find a way to prevent or even reverse aging, but an unprecedented study has now confirmed that we probably cannot slow the rate at which we get older because of biological constraints. A study by an international collaboration of scientists from 14 countries, including experts from Oxford, set out to test the invariant rate of aging hypothesis, which says that a species has a relatively fixed rate of aging from adulthood. Our findings support the theory that rather than slowing down death, more people are living much longer due to a reduction in mortality at a younger ages, said José Manuel Huberto from Oxford's blah, 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 blah. We compared birth and death data from humans and non-human primates and found this general pattern of mortality was the same in all of them. It suggests that biological rather than environmental factors ultimately control longevity. The debate over how much longer we can live has divided academics, blah, blah, blah. And so this sort of plugs the gap. A high risk of death in all the data sets. So they investigated multiple data sets, and all of the data sets confirmed the same general pattern that a high risk of death in infancy, which rapidly declines in immature and teenage years, remains low until early adulthood and then continually rises in advancing age. In historical populations, life expectancy was low because many people died young. But as medical, social, environmental improvements continued, life expectancy increased. However, the trajectory towards death in old age has not changed. So there you go. Worth noting.
Yes,
sir.
Yep.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about...
Since we're talking about such nice topics, a little bit about death.
Yes.
Very last factor here, coming towards the very end. Just look at the definition of death before we discuss that a little bit. So what is death? Passing away of various beings from the various orders of beings. They're perishing, breaking up, disappearance, mortality, death, completion of the time, the breakup of the aggregate, the laying down of the carcass. This is called death. Is that your translation? Sure, not quite.
I have perishing, disintegration, demise, mortality, death, decease.
Okay.
Sounds like the dead parrot sketch.
So just to make it very clear again that this obviously means death in the ordinary sense of the word, doesn't mean anything apart from that. Now, the interesting thing about this, at least that's one of the interesting things about this from my perspective, is that dependent origination doesn't just end with suffering. It doesn't just say that, you know, all of this leads to suffering. It specifies old age and death, which is kind of fascinating. Why doesn't it just say, well, you get born and you suffer as a consequence? Why does it specify old age and death? And one of the reasons, I think, is because it wants to specify the idea of the samsaric existence, the kind of round of birth and death. And if we just say suffering, it is not so clear that this is meant as a process that kind of carries on. By specifying death, you can infer that the further process of rebirth is also implied by that, in a sense. But I think also the idea why death is kind of specified in this way. I mean, old age is there, but of course death, in a sense, includes the idea of old age within it. So death is really the main issue, the main thing at stake here. And I think the reason why it is singled out in this way is because death sort of encompasses almost all aspects of suffering within that one experience of life. So much is included in that. Death is such an important point of suffering in human existence. And we know that. The fear of death, the fear of future, is such a kind of large thing that kind of hovers over human life, and it makes the future always so uncertain and unreliable. We do so much. Our society is obsessed with trying to safeguard people, not people shouldn't die. And if one person dies in an accident, we go to great lengths to try to find out the cause that we can stop it again in the future. And part of that, I think, is cultural, why we are so obsessed with people dying. I don't know personally whether death is necessarily such a bad thing. Always. It is, it really depends. I think from a Buddhist point of view, far more important than life or death is actually how we live. How we live is really what matters. You can have a long life, but if you live badly, it's not very all that useful. So the idea here is that death comes here at the end of dependent origination. And if you read about the suffering in the First Noble Truth, you have the jati pidukkha, birth is suffering, and then again you have old age, and sometimes you have illness, and then you have death again in the First Noble Truth. So this is kind of, again, a very significant part of the Buddhist idea of of what suffering is, because it includes so much of human suffering into one point. Why is that? Actually, before I go on to why is that, one of the interesting things about death also is the whole idea of the Buddha's biography. When we read the Buddha's biography, and you find this in a number of suttas, it's really more like an autobiography, because the Buddha talks about his own life and what happened. And very often we think about the Buddha as a bodhisattva who practices for all living beings to be happy and all of these kind of things. But when you read the suttas, you realize that the motivating factor for the Buddha, or the Buddha to be, to practice the path, to try to find a solution to whatever, actually is not really to save all beings. In the suttas, the Buddha's main motivation was death. Yeah, death is the big thing that looms kind of in the background with the Buddha. He specifically talks about, there's a sutta in the Anguttara 3, 39, Sukkumala Sutta. Sukkumala Sutta. Anyway, something like that. Where he talks about what made him go forth, yeah? And the things that he talks about when they go forth, and this is very closely related to the Devadutas, yeah, the divine messengers that we talk about sometimes. And the things that made him go forth were precisely illness, old age, and death. Yeah, and of those three, death is the one that kind of encompasses the other two. When you die, of course, old age and illness usually are part of that. Yeah, so again, death is very, very obvious. Buddha talks about his going forth in the famous Arya Pariyesana Sutta, the Noble Search, Majjhima Nikaya 26. He talks precisely about the noble search versus the ignoble search. And the ignoble search is the knowledge that I am going to die. Yeah? Dying is going to be problematic for me. And then I end up attaching myself to wife, children, yeah, cattle, goats, all of these worldly things, which have the same nature as I have. They too will have to die. They too are going to disappear. So instead of trying to find a solution to the problem that I already have, I compound that problem by seeking other things that have the same nature as I have, the same kind of problem. So then the Buddha decides, based on that, well, I better find a solution to this idea of death. Not this idea, this reality of death. That is the noble search. Yeah. So what drives the Buddha in, or the Buddha to be, in his quest for, in his quest towards awakening, is actually the problem of death. Is there a solution to the problem of death? That is what the Buddha is looking for. And when you think about it, it's actually very audacious. Yeah, this idea, yeah, I'm going to just leave home, I'm going to find a solution to the problem of dying, is kind of remarkable, yeah? You don't find many people who say, yeah, I'm just going to leave my house here in Sydney and just going to walk into the forest and find a problem to the solution of death. It's kind of astonishing that anyone would want to do that. And of course, one of the reasons why the Buddha was able to do that, there's many factors, but one of them was that ancient Indian society encouraged people to do these kind of things. There was a very strong ascetic tradition with support for ascetic people. There were people who had already practiced a lot of practices that lead in the right direction, yeah, samadhi practices, these kind of things. So there was an established culture for this kind of search, and that makes it, of course, easier. Still, it is a very audacious thing to do that. So this was the Buddha's main motivation for deciding to renounce the ordinary life and become an ascetic. Yeah, that is the power of the idea of dying. It's a very, very powerful idea. You could go so far as to say the reason why we have Buddhism in the present day would be because of one person's profound insight into death. Yeah, that is the reason why we have Buddhism today. It is the Buddha to be contemplating the idea of dying to so profoundly that it actually led to what we now have as the Buddhist teachings. So what this means, of course, is that in part it means that the contemplation of death is a very important part of the Buddhist practice. Yeah, and the Buddha talks about, and you can see that not only for these reasons, the fact that it is at the end of dependent origination, is part of the First Noble Truth, it is part of the Buddha to be's awakening pursuit, all of these things, but also because it contemplation of death, called the Maranasati or Maranasanya in the suttas, is found in so many different places. Yeah, the Buddha talks about it again and again. He talks about the benefits of death contemplation. So it becomes quite obvious that this is one of the fundamental aspects of the Buddha's path, is to contemplate death. That is how powerful it is. You find suttas that talk about the basic contemplations, five basic contemplations in life, and these contemplations are illness, old age, death, the kamma. Kamma is your kamma is your owner of your kamma, and the last one is you will be separated from everything that you love and is attached to in this world. It's one of the five basic contemplations. Of those five, it is probably the most important one because it recurs in the most places in the suttas. So very, very powerful. Why is it so powerful? This is kind of the last question here. What is it about death that actually is so important? Why does it matter so much? One reason, I might talk a little bit more about this tomorrow. One reason, it is very useful as part of your meditation practice. If you're going to die, if that idea is really established in your mind before you start your meditation, before you start watching your breath or whatever, it means that the future doesn't really exist. The future is irrelevant. If you have a very clear idea that you can die at any time, then all of the future might actually turn out to be completely irrelevant. There is, in the long run, there is no real future. So the idea of death contemplation is to withdraw some of that interest of the sensory world, particularly when it comes to meditation practice, to enable you to go inwards instead and release that hold that the sensory world has on us. This is one of the reasons why it is very useful at that particular time. But it is also useful in a very general sense in life, because as we saw before, one of the things that it does, it changes what you value in life, what really matters in this existence. We start to understand that death, not only is death absolutely certain, I don't know if anyone here who kind of wants to be exempt from that reality, but death is certain, it is also, we just don't know when it's going to happen. It could happen at any time. This is kind of what is so worrisome about death. It's so incredibly unreliable. Or it is reliable in one way, but the when is unreliable. So what that means is that you start to understand that everything that belongs to this world is as unreliable as our lifespan. The things that belong to this world, which are so much of our life, revolves around the things that belong to this world. All our possessions, of course, including our house, including our car, including our most beloved things in this world. Your clothes, your robe, maybe, or your glasses, or my computer. Don't touch my computer. Don't look at my computer. The things that are really close to us in this world. Sometimes we have possessions that are very dear to us, maybe something we have inherited from a past generation or something like that. So all of those things in the world, because they are so unreliable, we start to place less emphasis on that. We don't value it so much anymore. And if we lose them in this life, if other people steal them, whatever happens, we are not so concerned about it anymore. We don't get angry and upset about that because we understand the problem of these things anyway. We focus on other things instead. Then there's all the people in our life. We know that on our deathbed, at the very latest, everyone is going to have to go. Dying is a very solitary experience. There's no one there to support you when you die. They can hold your hand until the moment you die, but the moment you're dead, you're on your own. It's true, isn't it? And people often don't think that you are really on your own. And to be able to deal with a situation when you are absolutely alone, you have to have the resources inside of you to be able to deal with that. External resources are no longer going to be very useful for you. Everyone in this world, the people who are closest to you, everyone is going to have to go. Then you have your inner...
But the other thing about that is that, like, when you die, you're on your deathbed and all your relatives are like, don't go, don't go. And as soon as you're dead, they're like, please go, please go. And you're like, but I just want to be loved. No, we don't want you anymore. And if you hang around, then you begin to realize, you know, who really cared about you. If they really love you, they want you to be a ghost and stay there. Wouldn't
yeah,
they?
Probably, yeah.
I don't know.
This is the real love is pretty harsh, pretty difficult, actually, yeah. What does Ajahn Brahm say when he goes, the chanting for people, when the people are on the deathbed, Ajahn Brahm does chant and says, do you want the chant to prolong the life, or do you want the chant for a nice rebirth? Well, to die peacefully, to die kind of happily, which one do you want? And sometimes people are, you know, fed up of, oh no, I shouldn't say that. Anyway, heading in the wrong direction here. So so much of our identity as well is tied up with this world. Yeah, I mentioned this before, the idea of identity in concerning our family relationship, who we are in our family, who we are in our workplace, our education, our social status, whether we are rich or poor, whether we are male or female, which country we are born in, what culture we belong to. All of these things create our sense of identity, and it's all tied to this life. When you die, everything gets stripped, yeah? Maybe not everything, but there isn't much left when you're on the deathbed. Yeah? And of course, the last thing you have to let go of is your body. Yeah? Yeah? When you take away all of that, it's not there's not much left. And this is why the Buddha says you are ultimately only the owner of your kamma. Kamma sakka. Kamma is your own. What is that kamma? And that kamma that you have on your deathbed, if you have now followed this course of dependent origination, you know that kamma is equivalent roughly to your bhava, to the consciousness that you have created for yourself over a lifetime. What is that mental state like? And if that mind has you have built up positive qualities for yourself, you have built up a sense of peace in your life, you have done the right thing, lived in a good life, and when you come to the end of your life, you will have a sense of contentment about yourself. You will feel a sense, maybe even a sense of joy in your heart, because you know you have lived well. And then when you give up this life, when you give up a body that is very sick, when you give up all the burdens of this existence, actually, you may find that the death process actually is quite nice. You may actually enjoy the death process. Why? Because the end of the life can often be very troublesome, especially if the body is sick and falling apart, etc. You may enjoy the death process. But there's only one condition, and that condition is that you have to have built up the good qualities inside through this life. So this is really the outcome of death contemplation done well. When you do death contemplation well, it reminds you every day of the importance of living well. Yeah, living well is what matters. Everything in this world is so transient. Everything in this world is so impermanent, unreliable. You can't control it. It's going to go before you know it. Suddenly it's all gone. Yeah, and then the only thing you have left is the good qualities in your heart. So it reminds you that trying to create this life, to make this life just right, to have the right kind of wealth, the right kind of friends, the right kind of status, the right kind of promotion in your job, all that is empty. It doesn't have anything you can take with you into the future. Instead of focusing on those things, instead you focus on the process of how to get there. What is the process? Do you do things with kindness? Do you do things in life with care? Do you do it with compassionate understanding of other people? Do you avoid getting upset and angry when things go wrong in your life, and instead understand that this is just the nature of life as it actually is? So you start turning your life around. And this is, when death contemplation is done in the right way, this is the power that it has. Yeah? On your deathbed, are you going to argue with someone on your deathbed? Yeah, if someone says, I don't believe in rebirth, are you going to tell them off on your deathbed? What? You're not, yeah? On deathbed, you're just going to say, go away. I don't want to, I want to be peaceful. Don't bother me. I'm dying. Can't you? And this is the thing, yeah? So, and this is, I think, it just shows us the idea that death is found here at the very end of the path, reminds us of the importance of these contemplations in Buddhism, yeah? And done well. And for that reason, death contemplation is something every one of us should really be doing as part of our spiritual practice. Anyway, so that's what I say. What do you say?
Yeah, no, it sounds good. What I hear you saying is don't die. Ever.
Yeah, is that what I say? Yeah.
Well, that's why you get enlightened, so you don't die ever.
Yes.
Good.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
More or less. Yeah. I guess one of the things about Nibbana and the goal of Buddhist practice, the Buddha, ontologically, he talked about it in negative terms, and psychologically, he talked about it in positive terms. So Nibbana is the safe haven. It's the highest bliss. It's the peace. It's the refuge. All of these things that he would use to describe it very positively to make us want to be there. But at the same time, whenever he talked about it ontologically, he would always use negatives. It's the deathless. It's ajatang. It's birthless. It's the unconditioned. And all these kinds of words. And so when, this is a very carefully designed linguistic strategy to try to be able to talk about it in a way that is going to freak you out, but not too much, freak you out the right way. I think that to me, to keep coming back to that the fact that the Buddha was always talking in terms of like creating, he was creating a negative space. He was creating an absence. He was pointing to something that was not there. And whenever he's talking about Nibbana, it's always ni, it's going out of something. So yes, we want to fill that up with something, make it a lasting thing. But of course that's eternalism, and that's what we, you know, try to understand dependent origination to overcome that. Yeah. I don't know if that answers the question, but that's my answer.
I think one answer to that question is that the deathless, how it is used in the, this is Majjhimadikaya 26, this is the Arya Pariyasana of the Noble Search. It is the Buddha reflecting that I am trapped in these problems. And then he thinks, well, I want to search for the opposite. And he uses the word amatang at that point. At this point, he doesn't even know that there is any liberation from these things. Yeah. So at this point, the only contextual meaning it can have is means freedom from death. That's what it must mean. And so he talks about here, I am liable to old age, to illness, to death. And then he uses the opposite, which is then the ajara, the abhyadi. So it means the freedom from these kind of things. So I think that one of the main meanings when we talk about deathless actually is freedom from death. That's what it means. And that is a much more less loaded word than deathless, which sounds like, you know, some kind of state or whatever.
To be freedom from the conditioned, I think, might be a better way of putting it.
I mean, literally, it's a past participle, yeah? So amata is the undead.
Yeah. The undead.
Did the Buddha want us to become zombies? We're going to attain the state of the undead.
There's a book in that,
I'm sorry,
I think.
I'm sorry.
There's a book, there's something there.
I'm getting a bit silly. Getting a bit late.
Yeah.
One of our favourite websites was Buddhism and Vampires. And and talks about various kinds of things, but I always remember when I brought this up and we're having a Sangha meeting. Talking with Ajahn Brahm and a bunch of the other monks and so on, and the topic of Buddhism and vampires came up. And the main topic of interest among the Theravadins was whether vampires can actually drink blood after noon. If you're ordained as a monk, is that okay? Because you're drinking, but is it solid food for a vampire? So is that allowable or is that not? I mean, it's...
It's a very good question.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Dependent origination isn't finished yet.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's the one thing here.
What?
Yeah, we still haven't finished.
Go on.
Okay.
We can't end on a cliffhanger.
No, okay. That's it. Okay, there we go. No, so this is, yeah? So this is just the last part of it. So it doesn't end with death. It actually ends with, this is how sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair come to be. Yeah, so this is kind of the very last part of dependent origination. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering here.
Well, no.
That's what it says, isn't it?
No.
No, is it more?
No.
No? Okay. Gee.
When rebirth ceases, old age and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, sadness, and distress cease.
Oh, sorry, this is the wrong one.
That is how the entire mass of suffering ceases. You've been doing the wrong thing. You've been trying to make more suffering. Is that right?
Wait a minute.
We got it completely backwards.
Maybe I shouldn't be teaching these courses.
That's how this whole massive
suffering begins. Okay, so next time we can, maybe we have to do some changes next time around. This is not good.
Yeah. We're joking around, but it's also, I think it's an important point. Like one of the characteristics of the Buddha's teachings is he tended to present things in this way. So you tend to present like the rising of suffering on one hand and then the cessation of suffering. But when you explain it in detail, you sort of tend to focus on the arising side. And we've been talking about it throughout the whole thing as well. So we're not just focusing on the origin of suffering, but it is a path. And dependent origination is not just a teaching. It's not just a philosophy. It's a path. And it's a practice, and that practice is the practice that leads to the ending of suffering. You have things like the just remember the number now, the Upanishad Sutta, which then sort of inverts the whole thing.
1223,
yeah. where you invert the whole thing, and you start to go from suffering, you go to faith. And from faith, you go to joy. And from joy, you go to... What's the next one?
The answer is that if you understand the origination sequence, the cessation sequence kicks in. Yeah. So by understanding origination, actually cessation happens. So this is... Yeah. Anyway, so what... Do you want to... Okay, next one. Okay, so these are just, one of the things that happened recently while we did this course, someone asked, well, what is the problem? I don't understand all the suffering business. Why are you so obsessed about suffering? So we had to kind of explain the idea of suffering in Buddhism. And sometimes this is actually it's a useful exercise to take it for granted after a while. But actually it is important to do that. So just very, very briefly, these are the aspects of suffering, that life has plenty of challenges and problems, so we can all agree on that. The impermanence is a very important thing. You cannot hold on to anything in life. Everything has to eventually go, especially when you die. Yeah, so all the challenges we have, then the impermanence of everything. The problem of rebirth, the idea that the cycle goes on and that there is no final solution within that cycle of rebirth. This is more of the same. Forever, potentially. The various realms, you don't know whether you're going to be reborn in a good realm or bad realm. That is kind of worrying, isn't it? And very often the problem is that whether we make good karma or bad karma is not something that is in our control. It depends on how we get reborn. If you get reborn in a mafia family, almost guaranteed you're going to make bad karma. How are you not? If your parents tell you go and do bad stuff, well, that's what you're going to do. So it's very often outside of our ability. The conditioning is so scary, the conditioning process when you kind of, you don't know what's going to happen next. And then the last one, that there is a greater happiness, is that the standard happiness that we experience in the sensory realm is just a trifling compared to the kind of happiness that is available on the Buddhist path. So that's just very briefly, just a summary of those aspects of suffering here.
Okay.
Yeah, then what happens? The prominence of death. Okay, we talked about this already, so I'll leave that out. The significance of death, we talked about this already. What happens next? Okay, so what happens next? I can't remember what I got here. Suffering, I say, results in either confusion or searching. This is pretty much what you talked about before. Huh?
Yeah.
Searching is where it gives rise to faith, yeah? Upanishad Sutta, I can't believe I have all this stuff in here. It's just too much. So this is what happens Yeah, this is what Bhaktisiddhanta was just talking about. So you have, when you have suffering, if you deal with the suffering in the right way, it leads to faith. And then from that faith arises this whole sequence known as which Bhaktisiddhanta translates as nicely as dependent liberation. From the faith comes gladness, comes the rapture. This is meditation, what happens in meditation, tranquility, happiness, stillness, knowledge of vision according to reality. Perhaps dispassion, liberation, the knowledge of ending here. That's very, very, we're running out of time, so I'm just kind of doing this very, very briefly. And then what happens then when you have the knowledge of ending? What happens next? Oops, then comes the ending mode of dependent origination. We haven't even touched on this. And then at the very end of old age, death and suffering, and then what happens? Ding. That's good news, isn't it?
Very good. Sorry, very good.
So either you're an arahant or you are on the path. This is kind of the point of this. This is the person on the path. Yeah. Okay. So that's it.
Sadhu, sadhu.